Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 14 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. This episode is part one of our discussion on deconstruction and faith.
So what's been a highlight for you this week?
So highlight definitely is I submitted chapter 5, the rough draft, and chapter 6 of the dissertation, and I've written chapter 7, and now I'm just waiting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not all highlight, but it's, but there's a lot of highlight in there. Yeah.
That's a huge highlight. I mean, what you're saying is that you may well have your draft of your whole dissertation pretty well wrapped up, and if you get good feedback, then you don't have a lot more to do.
You got it. Yeah. Well, probably more. Yeah. I mean, a lot of little stuff to do, but I don't know.
Well, there's always that.
Yeah.
So that to me is never the hard part. The hard part is getting the content on the page, you know.
I am a little nervous because I don't know. It's one of those things you have no idea what the committee is going to say, what the advisor is going to say. Yeah. But
up to this point, would you say that you haven't had any major revisions you've had to do on chapters you've submitted?
Once I got past the proposal, I had major.
Well, of course, but, yeah. Which is so funny because for me, it was the proposal is like you scratch the surface. You basically say, here's kind of what I plan to do. And then it changed, like mine changed dramatically in some ways.
Gotcha.
So that's kind of funny, but in terms of actually submitting the content of your dissertation, that you haven't had to do any major revisions yet, have you?
No, small stuff, for sure, yeah. But not
so, nothing. So I guess, you know, thinking a little on the bright side, if you did have a major revision you'd have to do or something in one of these chapters, it would be the first time. And so,
well, that's true. That's true. There's another highlight.
I don't mean to skew it and put it in positive terms, because I know how frustrating that is, but you know,
but it did. I'm trying to think. It took me almost a year and a half between the time I passed comps, the exams, and when my proposal was approved, because it kept getting pushed back. So,
well, it took me 11 years from the time I had my proposal into the time I finished writing my last chapter.
That is,
and you did it in a year or less, so not so bad.
I guess I'll take it.
Yeah.
What's a highlight for you, Ben?
Well, for me, I mean, I got encouraging news this week or about a week ago now that my dissertation was accepted for publication. So
that's awesome.
So that was exciting, partly because I really shot for the moon on it. I mean, I tried to submit it to what I thought would be maybe one of the hardest publishers to get it published with. And by hardest, you know, I'm realizing now in talking with people actually that the publication world is very different for every field.
Oh, that makes sense.
In our field, you know, there's always an opportunity to self-publish stuff on like Amazon.
Right, right.
I mean, anybody can pursue that. But what I'm talking about is, you know, going through the process of submitting it to academic publishers that are, you know, that are working in the field. And so I decided to submit it to a publisher in Germany, and which actually was a move intentionally, not so that people wouldn't read it, because if it's going to be published in German, it'll be published in English. But it was actually so that it could be reviewed by peer reviews, because this particular series that I submitted it to it's reviewed by all the major journals. So anyhow, I was kind of shooting for the moon in that sense, and I was really delighted to find that they had accepted it after the waiting period here. So that was
super exciting.
Yeah.
What's a low light been for you?
Well, you know, we're going through a lot of transitions here at the college, and the good thing with some of those transitions are our department, the Biblical Theological Ministries Studies department, it's changing a lot because we have some people that are departing from us, yourself included.
Right.
The good thing in that is that all of the departures, you know, this year have been amicable. Mm-hmm. The folks that are leaving, they've left on their own volition. They're leaving for good reasons, you know. Mm-hmm. That's good. But the thing that can be a little discouraging is just knowing that, you know, we got friends who are leaving, knowing that the dynamics are changing. I'm optimistic. That's a good thing. We've got some great candidates who have been interviewing for some of these positions, but a low light is just kind of coming to the realization of how much the dynamic is changing in our department, and just being sad to see some good folks go.
Yeah, it's hard because change is often an opportunity for really good new things, right? Like, well, yeah. I mean, even yeah. for the department to have some fresh insights and new perspectives sure. is really good. But yeah, there is also loss involved in that.
Yeah, yeah, there is. And you know, and the fact that we've got a few folks, and I think it's over the last couple of years here, we will have had three new faculty members, you know, that will, or three faculty members that we'll have to have replaced in a span of 2 years, which in our department is, that might sound low, but that's actually a significant number.
Right. Percentage-wise, so it's pretty
percentage-wise, big. Yeah. So it's, you know, there's just going to be some changes. And that's just something I've been reflecting on a bit, but how about for you?
I think a low light for me. So have you ever had a day where, I mean, you don't do any night classes, do you?
Not anymore. I've done some in the past. Yeah. Actually, Vincent and I did Faith and Film as a night class
yep.
last spring, but I think we're going to try to do it as a regular day class now.
So one potential downside of night classes, I really like night classes because you get the longer, you know, kind of seminar style thing yeah. with the students, but one downside is you can think about the class all day and still not be ready for it when it comes. and that happened yesterday. And it, I mean, I was working on it, you know, off and on throughout the day. And then I thought I had a good 2 hour chunk before the class started where I was really going to get in and do, you know, update some grades and, but also really get my mind into it. And some things ended up coming up and I didn't have a chance to do that. And I went into class and just felt super tired and just not focused. And it was in an area that felt a little bit, yeah, I don't know. It's an area that I don't feel super confident in. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, sometimes I feel like I can kind of go in and rely on underlying knowledge that I've built, you know, over time, but this was not one of those. So it just, I think it turned out okay. You know, we had some good conversation and whatnot, but I don't know. There's something so disappointing to me as the prof when I have what feels to me like a bad class period. And yeah. particularly when it feels like it's my fault, right?
Oh yeah. I've been there before for sure. And you know, and sometimes it's, there's other factors you just can't control that can contribute to that too, especially with a night class mm-hmm. where the seminar style is great, but I don't know many undergrad students that are delighted to be in class at 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah, that's
especially true. When you're getting closer to 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
So it's stuff like that where, you know, that can definitely contribute because there are times even where I feel like, you know, even if you're underprepared for a class, sometimes the discussion can just go in a direction that it can generate some excitement and some energy. Mm-hmm. And that happening sometimes in the night format just is a lot more difficult.
Right.
So there is that. Yeah. So what's an insight for you then this week?
So I think one thing that has been fascinating to me is, so we're in the partnership development process, right? Getting ready to go yeah. overseas and talking to people about praying for us and also doing fundraising with that. And I think one of the things that is really interesting to me, and every conversation is very different. So I wouldn't say there's like a typical conversation that we're having. I mean, there's certain content that's the same because we're sharing our story, which is, you know, anyway, one of the things that's been really interesting is how even people who've been walking very closely with us, as we get into talking about what we're up to, it's interesting to me how many gaps there are in what people know about what we're doing. And here's the insight. It's not actually that specifically, but it makes me wonder, like, how often have I assumed that people around me know what I'm going through or what I'm up to? And maybe they actually have no idea. Like, even sometimes the people closest to me, I just assume that people know what's going on in my life. And I'm starting to realize, like, I think maybe that's not, yeah, that, yeah, I don't know. Which then, you know, to think back about times that I've felt unseen or undersupported or, you know, whatever, it's like, oh, maybe part of the issue is I just assumed that people knew what was going on and maybe they didn't.
Yeah, that's really interesting that I feel like I've noticed that happening some in the course of my life where, especially when it's things I think that you talk about certain people with, and then maybe you go into a different group and you kind of just assume everybody kind of understands you know, this situation you're going through, and then you realize, oh, no, wait, you know, there may be certain people in my life where they would understand that better because their circumstances are similar. And then there are other people where it's kind of like a lot more information would be required for them to be able to kind of grasp even what it is that I'm talking about or that I'm going through.
Yeah. Well, and then it makes me wonder too, what are people that I'm connected to going through that I should perhaps know, but I have no idea, you know?
No doubt. No doubt.
How about for you? What's an insight been?
Man, well, I've been thinking, you know, this is really maybe geared towards people who are listening to our podcast who are involved in academics anyway. It could be students, it could be others. But I think now back on how much agonizing I spent with all sorts of fantasies of worst case scenarios occurring in my mind. I'm serious. Like, I mean, dreadful worst case scenarios. Wait, that would so come are you to talking about mind.
The dissertation or?
Exactly. I was about to say that. Yeah. As it relates to my PhD program. And now that I'm done with it, and now that I'm like not only passed, but now apparently I'm even going to have my work published. I'm looking back at it now and I'm thinking, man, none of that came true. None of it. Not once. And I had nightmares. I mean, I remember waking up. I remember having dreams and vivid dreams. I even had it after I defended my dissertation and everything was well, but I have had dreams of like, you know, oh, I didn't get my dissertation in, or oh, I'm at the defense and everything goes so poorly, or I fail, or and none of that came true. And I think the encouragement, the insight in there is, and it's not that sometimes our worst case fears can't come true, but I'm guessing for most of us, a lot of those worst case scenarios never even come close to being true in academics.
Is this a target? Are you subtweeting me?
Am I? Why did you put something up that I didn't notice?
No. I
see what you're saying. You're talking about actually what you're going through.
Yeah. Well, because I feel it's like I remember. You, but yeah. I remember you talking about that and not being in it. Like walking through that with you, but not being in it. I was like, dude, you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
But like now that I'm in it, have this, I mean, maybe, I don't know. I have this fear that I'm just not very smart. You know what I mean?
Everyone, man, everyone in academia, I think, has some imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Like I've been following some folks on Twitter who apparently are in their PhD programs. I mean, they're just kind of random people I've come across, and I hear that a lot. And it's so refreshing when you hear like an established scholar who's like well-respected in their field say that. Right. And that's not me. That's not me by any means yet, but I'm like, I've heard established scholars say this, and I'm like, you mean to say you had doubts and fears? And I'm like, and you're like one of the most well-respected scholars in the field. So it's like, I don't want to dismiss the fact that some terrible things can happen to people in the academic world, and not everybody's story ends peachy keen.
Sure. That's true.
But like I, especially for those people who have a tendency towards worst case scenario thinking, which is definitely me, I'd say more often than not, those projections in our brains, which are very, by the way, emotive. I mean, it's like it feels like it's happening to you,
right?
Even though they're just projections in your brain. And so it's very difficult to convince yourself it's not going to happen when it feels so real. Mm-hmm. And so imagining best case scenarios becomes terribly difficult.
Yeah,
because you can feel the worst case scenario happening, even if it never will. But if you're like me and you're a worst case scenario type of thinker, my guess is more often than not, those things are not even going to come close to being true, because our vivid imaginations can create scenarios that are probably very far from actually happening. Gosh, it's just hard to convince yourself of it when you're going through it.
That's for sure.
Yeah. So a word of encouragement to anyone out there, and maybe even it's outside of academic world, even with our jobs or with families and whatnot, especially I think if we're worst case scenario type thinkers, to kind of rein that in and just remind ourselves.
What was something that helped you navigate that?
While I was in it?
Yeah.
Oh man. There were times where certainly like encouragement from people would come into play. But even then, like if you have a vivid imagination,
it's easy to discount it, right?
There isn't a lot that can fully convince you.
Yeah.
What might have helped save me from destruction was just a complete unwillingness to give up.
Right.
that I knew the one thing. I'm like, I may fail, I might crash, I might this and that, but I'm like, I will not give up. That's the only thing I could have going for me. And it's not like because I wasn't going to give up that I could look back and go, everything's going to be okay.
Right.
The real answer to your question is, I don't know. I wasn't always doing well. I wasn't always on stable ground. There were times where I would go to work fear and trembling mm-hmm. with every bit of doubt and every bit of, you know, just self-doubt in my mind. And it helped just to kind of still do it, still get to work even in the midst of it. So I guess the not giving up relates also to do the work in the midst of it. Because I think the worst thing you can do when you're afraid like that in any area of life is to let it rule you so much that you can't continue to do the things you need to do, especially the things that you need to do that would actually prove that narrative in your brain to be wrong.
Right. Because then it becomes self-fulfilling.
Exactly. Then it can become self-fulfilling if you give into it too much, because then the idea of like, I'm going to fail makes you fail because you're like, well, I can't do the work because I'm too scared.
Yeah. Huh.
So I don't know. I can't say I've got the solution, but that's, I think just keep going, keep doing the work, keep, you know, if it's an area that's not work related, just don't give in, don't completely give in to the thoughts. Don't ignore that they're there, be aware of them, but like, don't let it rule you, you know?
We'll be back in a moment with part one of our conversation about deconstruction and faith. As always, you can find out more at profsandrooms.com. In a few weeks, we'll be posting a lot of extra content from today's conversation for our patrons on patreon.com/profsandrooms. So are you drinking coffee this morning?
Yeah, I am drinking coffee. You know a little more about the coffee than I do, but it is fantastic. So it's Ayers Coffee, you said, out of Tennessee?
Out of Maryville, Tennessee. So there's the Brazil dark roast and then the Papua New Guinea dark roast.
So I drank through the Papua New Guinea already.
I found that to be incredibly drinkable. Oh, did you?
I just love coffee from Papua New Guinea, but they did a fantastic job with that. I mean,
the
roast of those beans were great. So yeah, I intended to save it. Now, you know, we had originally talked about recording last week. Mm-hmm. So had we recorded last week, I think I might have had some left. But since we didn't, now I'm on to the Brazil, which is also very good. I've even got this little Ayers Coffee mug here.
Me too. It's one of my favorite mugs.
Jill says, man, this is a cool mug. And she mm-hmm. said, do you want to leave it here? Or do you want to bring it to work? And I thought, well, I'll probably leave it at home. But then I thought, well, we are recording today, so I'll bring it with me and I'll drink my coffee out of there. It's good coffee. I tell you, I'm delighted by this coffee this morning. So, and I'm drinking it just black.
Yeah, same. Yeah. It's very good. A friend of mine sent it. She knows the owners and she was like, hey, would you guys be interested in trying some coffee? And I was like, well, yeah. So thank you, Carla, for the coffee.
Thank you, Carla. And now I'm actually going to go on their website and I now need to figure out how I can order some of their beans. So look at this. They even give you 10% off your first order. This sounds like an advertisement.
It sounds like we're getting paid for this, but we're not,
but I'm just looking for good coffee. And it was good. And I, you know, there's Papua New Guinea coffee that you can buy around, you know, I think Pete's has one. And I know that mm-hmm. Dunn Brothers has theirs, but the best coffee I've ever had outside of Europe was in Papua New Guinea, and it was black coffee. So I wish I could just get the beans in Goroka, which is the area that I was in, but these are very good.
So how long were you in Papua New Guinea?
And I was in Papua New Guinea for 6 weeks. And this was after I graduated college. It was, isn't that crazy to think, man? Not quite 20 years ago, because it was in 2003. I just graduated from college and I think I left around, must have been July.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So I was in Mexico while you were in Papua New Guinea.
Oh, yeah. Did you drink good coffee there?
Oh, yeah, I did. But so I was also supposed to have gone to Papua New Guinea.
With the same organization.
Same organization, yeah. And they canceled the semester that I was going to go. I was going to leave high school a semester early and go. It was my graduating semester in 2000. And I had gotten that all arranged. And then they canceled it because of Y2K.
Y2K?
Yeah, I remember that.
I remember that. I was working in the Christian bookstores when Y2K happened. And they had all these books out that were apocalyptic, you know, of right. what's going to happen with the world with Y2K. And so it was, those books, by the way, became very irrelevant
very quickly.
And they were on discount, $1.99, you know.
They probably made a lot of money in the short run, though.
They did.
Which is a little Sad. I remember I was working at a tech booth in a church running up to Y2K, and we had a service where the pastor wanted to illustrate like the suddenness, the unexpectedness of that. And I assume there was also a spiritual message. I don't remember that part. I just remember that we had to suddenly make everything go black in the room, man. All the lights off, all the monitors off and everything. And we were low tech enough that was a bit of a challenge. So, I mean, I guess we could have just flipped the breaker, but
it was one of the most anticlimactic apocalyptic moments, I think, in human history.
You know, I have a feeling that a bunch of our listeners maybe don't even know what Y2K is.
Like, you know, you might be right. So here's the thing, you know, wasn't it based off the fact that the computers had forgotten to actually have the ability to have a 20 in front of the numbers, like on the dates.
Yeah.
So there was all these questions on whether banking
years were just entered with the last two dates of what at that time was the 20th century. And then when we were flipping over, I mean, technically a century doesn't change until year one. Right. But anyway, but going from 19 to 20 was the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was fears that like 1999 going over to 2000 would almost make the computers think it was 1900 because you couldn't put the 20 in front. Right.
Yeah. And then so for some reason that was going to like, there was this fear that it was going to cause massive power outages and banking issues. Like you mentioned, I know, I mean, and the lingering effects of that have been weird too. Like, there was that company that made a whole bunch of money off of generators.
I knew people that bought generators and stocked up food, like thinking that, man, the power will be out for months.
Yeah.
And what's so crazy about it is literally nothing happened.
I mean, right? Do you think, I guess I have never heard whether that's because they did a good job patching the code or whether it was just not an underlying issue.
I'm sure they did. Yeah. It's not, it probably was somewhat of an issue. Otherwise, it made the news, right? Yeah. Not that that means much, but yeah, they probably fix it. But the funny part was, is that a lot of the people, I think in Christian communities hadn't really believed that it would be fixed. And so there was a lot of theorizing that it was going to be this apocalyptic moment, maybe even sign Jesus would come back or something like that. Right. It's just a reminder of how dangerous it is in some ways to be reading, you know, our eschatology through the lenses of current events.
I mean, how many times have we gone through a moment in culture where one of the major impacts one of the major ways that Christians have talked about it is to say, oh, see, this is, you know, it's right now. And I think, I mean, obviously there is the doctrine of the imminent return of Christ, right? That at any time he could come back, that he's coming back, and to live with expectation of that. But that feels different than saying, you know, okay, here's the evidence that it's about to happen right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've always noticed with things like this, not that Y2K was an American centric thing, because I think there were fears globally.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, right. Because my program in Papua New Guinea was canceled because they said, I'm trying to remember now, did I make this up? I don't think I did. I'm pretty sure they said that in the US, they're telling people to get water and food. And in Papua New Guinea, they're telling people to get water and food and guns. I don't know if I made that up or not, but it's the story I've been telling for 20 years. So. Wow.
But you know, there is something interesting, especially about reading current events in America as some sort of sign of the times, because it really comes with the implication that like America is in the central area of God's master plan for eschatology. Right. And so that's what I've always been kind of disturbed by in some ways, when people will read American news stories and think that whatever is going on in America must mean Jesus is on the hinges of coming back here. And I'm thinking, well, you know, there's more to God's master plan than just whatever's going on in America.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But that clearly wasn't one of those cases, but it is funny. And I mean, the Y2K stuff was such an interesting buzzkill in some ways for all these people who had expectations that it would be this like massive event. And then all these Christian publishers publishing books that are indicating that it's somehow showing that we're closer to the end of the end, you know.
I mean, what's interesting is I hear those murmurs again right now based on the political situation in the US.
Yeah.
And again, it's like, so I preached a message not too terrible long ago, maybe a couple of years ago, looking at it, it was rooted in Matthew 24, right? That wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and famines and that kind of thing. And when you look around the world, of course, that, that sort of thing is happening. But my point was, we should live with this expectancy that, you know, that how we live matters, you know, not necessarily saying, oh, look, here's this earthquake and therefore, you know, set your clocks, you know, for, you know, 12 o'clock today or whatever that, you know, this is happening.
Again, there's something when we look at like the American political situation and think that it's somehow indicative of the arrival of the end times in some special fashion, where again, we're centralizing the idea that America has some special place in God's master plan. I don't know. I'm not trying to be anti-American, but there's just something a little disturbing about it because empires have risen and fallen throughout the history of the world, including the empire that was around when Jesus was crucified.
Right.
I mean, I can't imagine how Christians would have seen the shifting powers of Rome losing its stability as not being an indication maybe of Jesus' coming. And yet that empire rose and fell and empires have come since. And so to me, I think it's dangerous to look at any one particular political environment and then to think that whatever's happening there is the key to unlocking where we're at sort of on God's great timeline or something. And it's not just America. It's doing it with any one particular environment.
So this makes me think of a couple of things that have been on my mind recently. Something I've been seeing a lot, who knows by the time we publish this episode, whether it will still be happening. But the last week or so, I've noticed a lot of conversation in kind of the... in the part of Twitter that I follow, I've noticed a lot of conversation about deconstruction of faith.
Yeah, I've seen a few of these, only because I think you've maybe reposted a few of them.
I think I have a couple of them. And I think that this is a question that is really important, particularly as professors, is thinking through, okay, on the one hand, how do we help people that we are teaching and training to deconstruct things in their belief system that are not true. And at the same time, you know, how do we not like
ruin them?
Yeah. Or the idea of truth, or, you know, like, I think that there are these risks of one of the comments that I saw that kind of seemed important in getting the ball rolling on in this conversation on Twitter was this idea that sometimes people are celebrating when someone's deconstruction leads them to give up their faith.
When deconstruction actually leads to destruction.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Not like destructing them as humans, but destructing their faith.
Yeah. And I think this is I'm thinking back to my early days teaching, and I very much remember the temptation to feel clever. And I think there's this temptation teaching that you want to feel clever, and deconstructing somebody else's world makes you feel clever. Does that make any sense?
It does, yeah. But this issue you're talking about, I think, is something we're both very passionate about. And it's one of the reasons I think why I wanted to teach and teach at Crown. Mm-hmm. And there's something, though, I feel like there are environments where deconstructing faith is done with the goal of destroying faith.
Right.
And part of it's because those who've deconstructed it themselves have looked back on it and seen it as invalid or unhelpful or worse, you know, deceptive. And so then they're wanting to take others along the journey with them.
Right.
And this isn't coming from a place of them being bad human beings. You know, this is just coming from a place to think of them recognizing the ways that maybe religion or things have been very unhelpful in their own life and even been couched in certain languages that they're now rejecting. And I think they want people to come on the journey with them. Well,
and even where religion or faith has been used abusively.
Abusively, right? Yeah.
Like, so, I mean, I think some of the desire, I think it's helpful that you mention that, because one of the things I hear you saying is that sometimes people are actively trying to not only deconstruct, but destruct. Is that a word? Destruct? Is that a word? No.
Destruct.
Anyway.
I don't know. It sounds like it's a word.
It sounds like it is.
Destroy. Well, destroy would be the word.
Destroy is the word, yeah. Anyway, people are not only wanting to like that sometimes people are actually wanting to destroy other people's faith, and they're doing it out of what at least to them feels like an altruistic motivation of helping people escape an abusive system.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's why I don't want to paint people who are doing that in academic environments, especially in some sort of, you know, dehumanistic light, you know, like I don't want to dehumanize them because mm-hmm. I think that they're coming from a place of often personal honesty of again, wanting to destroy some of the things that they're seeing in society that they've deemed to be unhelpful and even abusive.
Yeah.
At the same time, I certainly don't want that to be part of the program that I'm in. And this is what I think is the reason why I went through some deconstruction myself, especially around the time that I was in seminary and when I left college. And part of it was because of some of the cultural things I realized I'd bought into. I was starting to realize we're not actually anything based on scriptures so much.
Right.
And what that made me do is I was conflating certain practices and certain, you know, ethics even with the Bible, when actuality, all that it was oftentimes was this sort of cultural pressure. What that usually, what I think can happen is people can go through that experience and then they abandon the faith entirely. Mm-hmm. It's not that this doesn't happen, but I feel like it's quite uncommon for people to at some point become religious. Now, let's speak about Christianity, to buy it to some extent into Christianity, to immerse themselves more deeply into the scriptures, only to find themselves rejecting the Jesus they encounter in the scriptures.
So start it.
I'm not saying it doesn't happen.
Say it over
again. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I find it seems to be less common that people will somehow buy into Christianity. I don't want to use the word buy in. It feels less common to me, people who will accept Christianity to some extent, only to find themselves digging into the scriptures and reading the stories of Jesus, and then rejecting the Jesus they see in scriptures because it was something different than what they received. I don't see that happening.
What I see happening, it's almost the opposite, right? Like that as people encounter the Jesus of scriptures, they're like, this isn't the Jesus of Christianity. And then sometimes that crisis leads to abandoning faith. Sorry. What were you going to say?
No, that's right. I can't remember. I think I've already said this maybe on a past episode, but I found myself saying in class the other day to students that if they ever, you know, when they leave Crown, if they ever find themselves considering abandoning their faith entirely, I said, I hope that if you do, that you're abandoning the faith because you're rejecting the real Jesus that you've encountered in the scriptures mm-hmm. and not the Jesus that's a figment of your imagination.
So I feel like that's actually really important because I think that, and figment of their imagination is figment of our imagination. It's not ours. Necessarily.
I don't have the real Jesus. I'm not like, I don't believe I don't have everything right, you know, but the idea would be, is it based on our encountering the Jesus that is presented to us in the text, you know, and that is the Jesus that we are no longer sympathetic to, or is it that we're rejecting the cultural brand of Christianity that we found to be oppressive? Because mm-hmm. honestly, I want to encourage students to be able to do the one without the other, to be able to reject the cultural forms of Christianity that are oppressive and unhelpful and wrong, while at the same time, appreciating, adoring, latching on to the Jesus in the scriptures that I think is actually far different sometimes than Christianity is perpetuating.
Yeah. What's your journey of that been?
Man, I didn't really grow up going to church at all much. I did get confirmed, I think, when I was around 15 or so, and started going to church with my mom. I got confirmed in the United Church of Christ.
Grandpa was a UCC.
Yeah, I remember saying that. And it was a really powerful experience for me at the time. I can't say that at that point, I think what it did is it sparked my interest in Jesus and in religion, but I didn't know anything really about it. We did a lot of social activities. Mm-hmm. We didn't really read the scriptures much or anything like that. So I think what I was gaining an appreciation for religious activities without really knowing anything about the scriptures. And then a friend, invited me to youth group in high school at a different church. And they were much more about, you know, talking about the stories of the scriptures. And it, then that really, that's what got me. I was shocked. I couldn't, he'd sit up with me at night on the telephone. This is back in the day when you'd talk on the old school phones, you'd call. Nobody could call because the line would be busy, you know? Yeah,
exactly.
We'd talk and he'd tell me stories of the Bible. And I thought he was making them up. Like, I'm like, that's not in the Bible. My picture of what the Bible was very different than what it actually was. Mm. But at the same time, when I started going to that church, and they're great people there, great teaching in a lot of respects, but very steeped in a certain brand of Christian culture that took me many years to deconstruct, where I started to realize that the thing that they said Christianity was more about the perpetuation of a certain culture than it was because the scriptures say so. So for me, it was when I got to seminary, when I left Crown and I wasn't living under any system of rules like we had at Crown, where you sign a community covenant, right. I had to start wrestling through more ethical questions. I had to start asking the question, not of does my church approve or does Crown approve? I had to start asking, what does the scriptures say? Mm-hmm. And I started to realize there was some messiness to that in ways that was never acknowledged either at Crown when I was a student or in my church growing up.
Do you think there's a chance that it was acknowledged and you didn't have ears for it? Or do you think it was really not acknowledged?
That's a good question.
I suppose that's, I mean, at this point, it's conjecture. I don't know.
Here's what I could say. I'm sure there had to have been people who didn't think that.
Yeah.
But the people that and this could be against me self-perpetuating what I'd already believed at the time, but the people who I looked up to, the people who I gravitated towards and their teachings, whether at church or at college, were the people who were reinforcing some of those ideas.
That makes sense.
So you're probably right. I mean, there were people who had to be saying it, but I had to have been saying it, but I probably, you know, thought they were out of their minds or liberal or, you know.
Oh man. Yeah. It is funny. Like thinking about the stages of cognitive and ethical development, I'm thinking of William Perry's system and how there's this stage of dualism that people go through and it maps onto kind of the traditional sophomore stage and, you know, this idea of, you know, the wise fool. I mean, I remember some of the things that I believed in college, because the people around me who I looked up to said, this is true, that, you know, some of those beliefs that I was very much like, they didn't last long because they didn't have a lot of foundation to them.
But, well, and what I saw happening, and I didn't want to get too thick in the weeds here with this, but what I saw happening in seminary, I think, was, you know, there's this, people sometimes warn you about going to seminary or grad school because they think that'll be where you ruin your faith. Well, my faith was deconstructed there. But what I found to be so helpful about Bethel Seminary at the time was that it deconstructed without demolishing.
Yeah.
And actually what it did is it built up. So I had friends who were going to other places, and this isn't to demonize those places necessarily. It could have been their own journey, but where they were completely just worn out. I mean, the academic journey in their master's programs did not lead to the building up of their faith, but led to them just feeling dry and stagnant, stale, and in some cases destroying. Where my experience was very different. There was a deconstructing, but it was also actually energizing me. It wasn't causing me to want to abandon faith. It was causing me to want to explore it even deeper. So what that led me to just quickly is that's why I wanted to teach. I'm like, I want to go back to the place that I was at, and I want to help walk students through if they're on that journey of realizing that you can reject some of these cultural forms of Christianity that are deeply unhelpful, frankly unbiblical, and whatnot, without actually losing your faith and actually having your faith energized by it.
Yeah.
Whether I've done that well or not, I don't know. But that's kind of been at the core goal of what I want to do to teach, is to carry people on that, help them all on that journey.
So I've heard different metaphors used recently for the deconstruction process, you know, like, is it a renovation of your faith? Is it, you know, like if you think of it as a building, like, is there a foundation level problem? Is there like, what, how deep do you think the issues went that you felt like you needed to walk through?
Oh man, that's tricky. It's hard to even say. I know they went extremely deep to the extent that, to this day, you know, and I see it even in my group of friends, and we talk about it, you know, there are intuitions that you have sometimes that you still get that you kind of wonder, am I thinking this because I'm a Christian, because I've read the scriptures, and because this is maybe how Jesus would want me to think? Or am I thinking this way or feeling this way because of the remnants of the cultural stuff that I've picked up on that maybe aren't that?
Yeah.
And it's hard to know. There's times where I think I'm still feeling it, and I'm like, I don't know. I that's a hard question to ask in terms of if it's a problem on the foundations or how deep it goes.
Maybe that's not the, I don't know if that's the best metaphor either.
I don't know either, because I like the idea of deconstructing, because to me, what it is it's almost like a surgery, you know, like you're able to somehow the process you're going through is trying to find the parts of your faith that are untrue.
Yeah.
And unhelpful. And while at the same time, not like without killing the body, you know, it's like if you're doing surgery, you know, it's like you got some extent, you got organs that need to be removed or something, you know, or you've got these elements that have to be pulled out, while at the same time, you can't destroy the body. You know, it's like, I don't know, there's something there in that image that to me makes sense.
I think the only thing that I don't know, the risk to me in that particular illustration would be that sometimes it makes it sound like maybe the untruths are very small compared to the overall body.
Well, that's why I call them organs, right?
Okay, fair enough.
Most of the time, you can't do without a lot of organs, you know.
I'm thinking about my journey. So I grew up in church, but not necessarily in faith, if that makes sense. And it was in my sophomore year of high school that faith finally, you know, it's like, okay, I would say it was in my sophomore year of high school where I finally understood at a core level, knowing Jesus. So not just intellectually. So then I was hungry for, okay, what does this mean then? And I remember, I mean, I was doing I was doing like three devotionals a day, three quiet times a day.
I remember those days.
And then
they're long gone. I mean, right. In some ways, even just pragmatically, I tell students, I'm like, look, you know, if you rest all of your, you know, spiritual vibrancy on all these disciplines, like good luck when you've got a couple of kids and a full-time job. And it's not to diminish that we can't take that time still, but anyway, it's a side comment. But yeah, I remember those days, you know.
And I was always listening to, you know, Christian radio stations like the Bible Answer Read and all that. And then I went to a Christian college with the goal of becoming a missionary bush pilot. But I wanted to know what this faith was. And there were some people there who had really firm answers for me. And I remember one prof in particular who was a favorite prof of many and was of mine when I started, but not by the time I finished. But he would say, you know, you can disagree with me, you'll just be wrong. Right. And he would say it like a joke, but it wasn't a joke. Right.
No, I had a prof like that as well. Yeah.
And I remember in college, I think in some ways, one of the first things that really started to break down that edifice, that building that had been constructed, because I would say the faith that was being constructed for me at that school, there were some things that were really good and really true and that I'm really grateful for, right? Like, I feel like I learned so much of the scripture there that I had no idea when I started college that the Bible had one continuous narrative.
I had
no clue. And I remember learning that for the first time. I was like, oh, wait, so the Old Testament and New Testament relate to each other in a particular, I know. I don't know if I missed it or what.
We had Torsten on earlier, and Torsten was the one that just, it totally exposed me to that. I took his Gospels class, and it's like all of a sudden, he was making connections with the Old Testament and stuff in ways that I hadn't seen. And that's not, no offense to the profs I had here at Crown, because some of them were fantastic, but but I wasn't quite getting that. And when I did, it was like it completely opened a new horizon.
Oh, it's me. And it's beautiful, right? It's like there's this beautiful thing in scripture. And I just. And so I'm so grateful for that. And at the same time, there was also this false thing being built up, which was this very, in retrospect, it was a very nationalistic Christianity, which is weird because the school had Mennonite backgrounds. So it's like, where did that even come from?
That seems like an odd marriage.
It really was. And it was also, you know, very patriarchal, and it had like, you know, these, the culture wars approach to Christianity. And I remember when I was in Mexico in 2003, so the U.S. was in a process of the war with Iraq. And I remember meeting Mexican believers who had a completely different understanding of what it meant to be Christian and what it meant to be a global citizen. And I remember sitting in a workshop that Luis Bush did. He was doing survey work all across Latin America. And somehow the group of six of us that were there for 6 months got invited to this thing at La Iglesia Torre Fuerte. You know, we were sitting there and doing this, this survey, and in the survey was included questions like, you know, what is the greatest threat to the church today? And, of course we all, you know, being good American, Bible college students, you know, I'm sure we put something like, militant Islam or something like that. And like all of, I don't know if it was all, but the vast majority of the Mexican pastors put, globalization was the biggest threat. And we were like, no, globalization is like how the gospel's spreading. And we were like, what is even happening? And I remember talking with a Mexican pastor. There was a moment where this was a different day. We had gone to visit some church. It was, I think, the only time we visited that church. And at some moment, the missionary had stepped out of the room, and the pastor like huddled us up together. And he was like, just so you know, the Mexican church would be much healthier if all the missionaries left. And we were like, what? Like, and that began the process of deconstructing ideas. Like, cause I thought at that time, and now I realize it was very foolishly, I thought that Christianity was centered in America, and it's not. And it, like,
and the missionaries that are going out for America are doing God's work, you know, entirely. And they, all those people out there need us.
Right.
Right. Like,
I think it's interesting to me that deconstruction for me actually began with other Christians from another part of the world saying, hey, like, actually, no, that's not the faith that I have. Like, I'm not sitting here waiting for America to come deliver me. You know, I'm actually maybe praying to God for deliverance from, but I think then I, in my graduate program, I did not go to a Christian college. I felt led to for grad school. I felt led by God to a program that was actually very challenging to my faith. It was an international or intercultural relations program. And one of the things that happened in that program is things started to get deconstructed at the level of epistemology and even ontology. Yeah. And I began to realize that I had beliefs about faith that were tied to certain ways of knowing, and beliefs about faith that were certain, that were tied to certain understandings of even what the core reality of the universe is.
Yeah.
And I realized like those core beliefs that I have are not actually universal, meaning, you know, not all humans hold these core beliefs. And yet some of the humans who hold different core beliefs than I do also hold to Jesus. So Jesus' faith must not be built, must not require this certain epistemology or this certain ontology.
If it did, I mean, what do we do with the first century, you know, Christians?
Right. Because what would we do with us, right?
Like, what would we do with us? The like, there's no way they can think exactly about the world like we do.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, all of the history that's happened since then and the developments, you know, with the Enlightenment and even the, you know, even technological or, you know, movements and revolutions. I mean, like, there's just certain ways we see the world that just are would be unfathomable to people in the ancient world. And not meaning that, look at the progress we've made. you know,
just meaning some, it's some, like very
just
different.
Meaning it's different. Yeah. I don't want to paint the portrait of the, of people in the ancient world as primitive or anything like that. Right. I don't mean that. But it is that we would think very differently. If we were to somehow be in the same room, you know, and speak in the same language, I think we'd find we see the world very differently.
Thank you for joining us for part one. In part two, we dig into our own experiences of doubt and what the mustard seed of faith that Jesus talks about might be like. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. Reed Peters is a recognized patron. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.